honorable members, minister, DG, and the team. Honorable members, we also have another important member from Al Jamaa, who, out of interest, is here, specifically because of the items that will end. And so he will be here, he will participate as guided by the rules. So I just wanted you to know. Oh, you can't hear me? Oh, okay. Okay. So I'm saying we've got a member from Al Jamaa. I might be pronouncing it wrong. Who is going to be part of us here. But let me welcome everybody, including him and members of the public. If there are any media, you are all welcome. The meeting is open. And can I ask for the adoption of the agenda, the proposal for adoption? Honorable Singh is proposing adoption. Any seconder? Seconded by Honorable Modise. The agenda is adopted. Any apologies? Honorable Singh.
Oh, Chairperson, looks like the disco is starting behind me. Somebody's left their bag there with the phone on and disappeared. Chairperson, I'd like to leave at 11:45, please. Thank you.
Honorable James Larimer, my apologies, he won't be able to attend today. An apology for the Deputy Minister.
Sir, I would like to register the apology of Honorable Mchunu.
Secretary says Honorable Paulson from EFF as well. Apologize. They are all noted, those apologies. Today we do have the item introductions, but I think we have been doing it throughout. I would suggest that anybody now who stands up to speak, if you suspect that we don't know you, you must introduce yourself. But if there's any contrary view to that, I'm saying we have been repeating that item. So it looks like everybody is nodding, but anybody who feels he must introduce himself before he speaks, I think we'll have to do that. From the apologies, you can easily note that members might just leave us in the middle of the program. So hence we must stick to time. Those who are going to present must take that into account. Honorable Minister, some members have whispered to me that they can suspect that when we have got long presentations, we don't have enough time to ask questions. So let's balance that as we do the presentation. So that's just one message I would want to pass. But otherwise, now we're moving to item 2, overview by the Minister of Environmental Affairs. Environment, forestry, and fisheries. We're still learning. Honorable Barbara Cressy, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members. Chair, as you have noted today, we're going to be making two presentations. The one is with regard to the status of air quality. And I think the honourable members have made an important point that they would want to have time to discuss this matter. I think this is a matter that is in the public domain. It's a matter that must of necessity be of interest to public representatives. And the guidance I would want to give to the team is that we have a number of slides that are reporting station by station. I'm sure you would not want us to go through all 100 plus stations. But I think that the honourable members had asked that that information be made available. And the guidance I would give to the team is that you would explain what that evidence is about, but you would not take us through each and every weather station, unless, of course, you want it, in which case I'm happy to be here. My next important engagement is on Sunday afternoon, so until then I'm happy to be with the honourable members so we can discuss each and every weather station. But, colleagues, I think that it's also important to say, by way of introduction, that you would know that we have put in place certain priority air quality areas. These areas would be in the Mpumalanga Highveld, they would be in Limpopo, and also in the Vaal Triangle in Gauteng. And you would also know that it's a matter of public record that the department is in court with civil society over the question of the status of the air quality, particularly in the Mpumalanga Highveld. I think it's important that I say to honourable members that the real legal challenge in that case is that civil society is asking me to prescribe regulations under Section 20 of the National Environmental Management Air Quality Act of 2004 and implement those regulations so that we enforce the priority areas air quality management plan. And I think that I would want to say outright that I have asked our council to settle this matter. I have no objection to bringing in regulations. And I don't think that it's correct that we should be in court over a matter which is required by the regulatory environment. So I think it's important to say that at the outset because I think that this is a matter that would be of interest to committee members, and of course if there are any representatives from civil society here, it would also be of interest to them. Having said that, I would just want to hand over to the team so that they can make the presentation.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister, DDG, DG, and all those in attendance. By way of introduction, I am Vumile Senene, a director in the department responsible for air quality management services, and I will be doing the first part of the presentation, after which Dr. Gwaze will do the remainder of the presentation. In essence, the presentation seeks to give an overview of air quality management in the country, and then the rest of the presentation then will focus on the state of air that we've reported for the period of 2007 to 2018. What we'd like to emphasize is that since the dawn of democracy, the government has spent a lot of time reviewing past legislation that in fact has not defended the rights of our citizens to an air that is not harmful to their health and well-being. And as a result, the Constitution then enshrines everyone's right to an environment that is not harmful to their health and well-being, and to ensure that the environment is protected for the benefit of present and future generations. And also to indicate that the era that we come from was that the laws didn't really look at how the citizens were protected. And so the Equality Act, what it did then was to basically align itself with the objectives of the Equality Act. And then for the first time in the country, we prescribed standards for ambient air quality, meaning basically now we told South Africans what the air quality that is acceptable to their health is. And we also created mechanisms to ensure that we're able to achieve the desired ambient air quality standards. And to also indicate that for a significant amount of time, South Africans had been breathing air quality that was not conducive to their health and well-being. But unfortunately, because of the lack of monitoring as well as reporting, South Africans did not know the quality of air that they were breathing. And so what we saw was a transition from an old act that did not focus on ambient air quality, but focus on individual sources. And what this created was that we had hotspots that are across the country, and I will talk later to the priority areas that we have. But unfortunately, this poor planning, if I can call it, created the hotspots, allowed industries to agglomerate in one area, but also unfortunately created a special pattern where low-income settlements, poor communities, were actually situated in very close proximity to this hotspot. And that is the current challenge that we are dealing now with. And that's why, as you'll see later on, we declared priority areas. But there were also other technicalities around the management of emissions that, to a large extent, there was no transparency as to what industries were emitting into the environment, and that people didn't know what these industries were doing to the ambient air. But as a result of the transitioning to the Air Quality Act, we're able to create more transparency. We're able to focus on the ambient environment so that we put interventions that are aimed to improve the ambient air quality. And overall, reporting and the measurements of emissions has improved significantly as a result of the Air Quality Act. In this particular slide, we're trying to demonstrate that the problem of air quality is a very complex one, in the sense that we have multiple sources of emissions that are going out into the environment from different sources. And also the challenge would be that even in the ambient air, chemistry comes into play, where there are chemical reactions, chemicals transform, and so forth. But also to indicate that it will not be a straightforward solution in terms of trying to address air pollution by targeting maybe one particular source. It has to be a holistic approach, ensuring that all the sources that contribute to a particular airshed are managed effectively. And what also we put into place was a requirement for industries that have been built many, many years ago to come into the new way of doing things. So the Act of 1965 had very limited requirements of industries. As you can see, for example, for power generation, for the likes of Eskom, they were only required to really monitor and manage one pollutant, which is particulate matter. Dr. Gwaza will describe that later on. But as we transition, we expected these industries basically to clean up their act and then come into compliance with what we had in 2015. So we had a staged process where we were attempting to get these industries to move from one point of emissions to the next. So ultimately, the goal was for them to comply with 2020. But in essence, what we are requiring was for a beetle of 1965 or 1950 to transform and act like a beetle of 2019. And that was what we had put in, a very ambitious goal to get these industries to move to that point, driven, of course, by the pressing need of the air pollution problems that we had. Hence, that there was a drive for that. But also to indicate that we had expected since 2010 for any new industry that comes into our country to comply with new plant standards. So we wanted, at that point in time, anybody who designs, builds a facility or a plant to know what the country's objectives and goals for air quality management are. So as you can see, since 2010 all the way to 2020 and beyond, new plants had been expected to comply with new plant standards. However, the challenge has been with existing facilities, because these facilities now have to go through almost a similar process to behave as if they are new plants. But the reality, as we all know, it is not an easy thing. You cannot overnight expect a facility that is that old to transform and act like a new facility in a very short space of time. And so what the law did was to make a provision for these existing facilities through a postponement period for them to put the necessary interventions, plans, and so forth for them to come into compliance. And this is where currently we are sitting, that the law provides for those facilities to go through this particular exercise. And what we have then is that as part of the tools of the Air Quality Management Act was to establish what we call a minimum emission standards. And this is the least that we require of companies to do because of their impact that they will have on air quality. And so large scale activities which as individual emission sources result in significant emissions are managed as listed activities in the Air Quality Act, and they require a license and they must actually comply with the standards. And associated with that, the minister has published standards that these companies must comply with. And one of the biggest achievements in the Air Quality Act is the fact that we are able to set a benchmark for all new industries. So I can say with a high level of certainty that all the new plants that have been built in the country are in compliance with the new plant standards. However, the challenge of transitioning these old facilities into new facilities is what currently the country is battling with. And even though we do have that problem, we have been able to actually improve management of emissions in our country by ensuring that we are clear in terms of monitoring and reporting. We have improved enforceability as well as transparency that the community can know what facilities are doing in their area of jurisdiction. Another key area that we focus on is around ambient air quality monitoring. As I indicated before, South Africans had no information as to what is the quality of air they are breathing. The Air Quality Act put a requirement that government must monitor ambient air quality, assess compliance with that ambient air quality, but also then report to the public as to what is the state of air. And that's why we are here today, to ensure that you also get to have sight of what the air quality looks like in the country. And so the ambient standards basically define the targets for air quality management, and they tell South Africans at what level is air conducive to our health, and at what level above that is health is the air quality detrimental to your health. We have focused on specific pollutants that we want South Africans to know about. The first one is particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide, ozone, benzene, and lead, but Dr. Gwaze will go into detail on that one. But also we are mandated, as indicated, to monitor and report. And you will notice that the number of stations tend to be concentrated in urban areas because we are targeting areas of sources of emissions, but also the highest number of people that may be exposed to that air pollution. And also we have specific tools that we have developed that help us to manage air pollution. As you can see, those are some of them, but I would like to focus on this number five, where basically we are saying that in low-income settlements, the specific challenges with regards to air pollution, the burning of coal and other dirty fuels, that poses a significant impact on health. We want to focus on that one as well. And then Honorable Minister has mentioned that we have three priority areas. These priority areas are as a result of the hotspots created in the past. We have three of them. And also, we are then trying to manage pollution more proactively in those particular areas. And this is a map of where these where the priority areas are located. And this indicates the fact that we are transitioning, and to indicate that this is not a complete process, it's an ongoing process. It requires time. Other countries have gone through something similar. It has taken a time, but the government is clear on its objectives to try and improve equality in our country. And we have also been clear on the governance cycle of equality, what is needed to manage equality in our country, specifically around the whole regulatory cycle, developing standards informed by the problem, doing compliance and enforcement, and so forth. But also, what we have done is that we have set specific responsibilities for each of the spheres of government. So at national, we are responsible for setting norms, standards, policies, and so forth. Provincial government departments have a primary responsibility of ensuring that they monitor the performance of local government and also integrate any other equality management actions in the province. And then finally, with local government. Local government carries the most important part in this work, which is administering and enforcing equality regulatory instruments. So that's where implementation takes place, and that's where most of the work needs to be done. And so the municipalities have taken a big chunk of the work. However, historically, they haven't had the function always. They had to build capacity, increase staff members, but also train those who are already employed by the municipalities. Over the years, municipalities have made strides in actually fulfilling this responsibility. However, capacity constraints still exist, and specifically in the areas of licensing and ambient air quality monitoring. And so they were responsible for transferring all the old licenses. As indicated before, we had very old licenses. Municipalities were responsible for putting the new requirements into their licenses and managing those processes. And just to give you an indication, at the time of the transitioning, these are the number of facilities that had registration certificates that existed at that point in time. Municipalities still continue to manage those licenses. As you will see, they are pretty much skewed across Gauteng, KZN, and maybe Mpumalanga. These are areas of significant economic activity in our country. And then finally, as my last slide, just to indicate that specifically in the HPA, there has been significant improvement by government to increase capacity. As you can see, prior to us declaring the priority area, there were no air quality officers employed by the three municipalities in those areas. Subsequent to the declaration, there was an effort to ensure that all of them had air quality officers. The number of districts that had air quality management plans, there was only one. Now we have two out of the three. But also, if you look at the kind of enforcement activities that had taken place, there's been a significant improvement since 2015. But also to add that in the past, we had only six officials at national department responsible for managing the rest of the country, all the number of activities that you saw. But with the transitioning and the decentralization, we have a situation now that across the country, we have more than 400 air quality officials managing air pollution for us. So that will be the end of my presentation, and I'll hand over to Dr. Gwaze to do the rest.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, honorable minister, the DG, the DDG, and the members in the room. I will give you an overview on the state of air quality in the country. As the honorable minister has indicated, there are many slides in this presentation, but I'll give highlights from one slide and move on, give a description on one slide and move on in the interest of time. As Mr. Senan has indicated, it is a legal requirement for government to monitor air quality, assess compliance with the ambient air quality standards that we have described, and provide information to the public. And for that, government has invested significantly in deploying ambient air quality monitoring stations across the country. We have 136 ambient air quality monitoring stations that have been commissioned since 2005. we have established what we call the South African Air Quality Information System, SAQIS, in brief, and I'll use this term going forward. Since 2009, this is a partnership between the department and the South African Weather Service in a system that provides information to the public. We have also set up an air quality standard as has been prescribed for the minister to do so. On this slide, even though it's very wordy, what's important to note is that in the first column is the pollutants that we have identified as criteria pollutants that we need to monitor. And in the third column is the concentrations that we define as thresholds, as the levels of pollution that if we go above those levels, we are now in non-compliance with ambient air quality standards and we are not protecting the South African population as we need to, as regarded by the Constitution. So based on this information, when you do ambient air quality monitoring, we are measuring our performance against the standards to show compliance or non-compliance. Across the country, we have commissioned, as I've indicated, 136 stations. These stations are located in the areas where we know we have the largest population distribution. All the metros are monitoring. The high flow area in terms of Gauteng, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and Northwest, we have ambient air quality monitoring stations in those areas because these are priority areas as well. These stations have been commissioned by national, and the national stations are managed by the South African Weather Service. We have the provincial stations in yellow, and we have the municipal, district, local, and metro monitoring stations in pink. All these stations, the majority of them are reporting to our SAQIS, but we are also in the process of bringing in private stations that are owned by most of these big industries so that we complement the network of monitoring in the country. And when I show you in the presentations that follow, you will see that we've got monitoring from SASO, from KUHA, IDZ, from Richards Bay Clean Air Association, and the ESCOM monitoring stations are also going to be coming online that complement the government network that we have. A typical monitoring station looks like the picture that you have on the screen. It's a shelter, 2 meters by maybe three meters, that contains a very expensive set of equipment. That alone is possibly 2.5 million rand or 3 million rand. The equipment is stored in a special shelter where we have to maintain the temperature inside the shelter because our instruments inside can only measure within a very, very narrow temperature range of 25 plus or minus 3 degrees. Therefore, we need air conditioners inside. We need power connection inside. We need security. That's why the whole place is fenced. The masks that you see, or those tall items, one of them, the very tall one, is measuring met conditions. So it's measuring temperature, wind speed, wind direction, and pressure, because we need those information to also understand how the pollution is dispersing in the atmosphere. What you see right on top of the shelter is the what we call the tubes that collects the air from the ambient air and brings it inside so that the analyzers can and the instruments can measure. Inside, this is what a typical station looks like. We have the analyzers that, again, are stored in a controlled environment because we can't contaminate the environment where the analyzers are measuring. And those are the different analyzers. And that monitoring station is actually the Mokopane station in Limpopo. And we have a laptop or a computer that we keep on site because the information from the analyzers is fed through special software to the computer before it's finally disseminated via cell phones to the South African Air Quality Information System. We have had challenges with security inside because, as you can see, this equipment can be very, very attractive to the people, and we do have some issues that we'll discuss at the end of the presentation. So how does this information move to the SAQIS? The monitoring station information is transferred through a range of the equipment or software until it gets to our SAQIS, the server that is hosted by the South African Air Quality, by the South African Weather Service. The information is then sent by the public via the website or via what we call the SAQIS app. And I have to, if you allow me, Chair, I just have to just show you what the SAQIS looks like. And we encourage the members to download the South African Air Quality Information System app. It's an application tool that's available to all the softwares, either it's Android or it's iOS. And what you see with that software is that from all the monitoring stations that I'm describing, the information is right available to you in real time, and you can see the quality of air. Just one more thing to mention. One of the things that we've also done in the upgrade that we have commissioned for this system in 2017 is that when you are sitting in the office as a technician, because you are not always on site, how do you know whether the analyzers are working or not? In the SACWIS system, we have the ability to remotely access all our analyzers across the country. And this is an important tool for us, because when the power goes down, you need to reset the analyzer. And instead of driving to all those locations that are sometimes remote, we are now able with this new software to remotely access your analyzer on site and reset the analyzer, reducing the downtime of the instrument and improving data recovery. So what does the data recovery from this monitoring network look like? And I'll share with you some of the information. I will focus on the colors and as the presentations are. It's a little bit difficult to read on the screen. So what you see on this slide is all the monitoring stations in the country, as the slides will follow. In green is the data recovery for a month for each station, where we say for all the analyzers, was the data recovery up to par? For us, data recovery has to be about 75%, and we're moving continuously towards improving to higher levels. What's in yellow is where we did not achieve 75%. So if I look at the top monitoring station, MLO, we have achieved, of the 6 months that we have information for, the last 2 months, July and August, are still being quality controlled, quality assured. Four of those months where the data recovery was up to speed or even up above. However, the 2 months in February and March where we lost data, it was mainly due to the times where we were having the rolling power outages and we were losing data from the monitoring stations. So in the interest of time, this is the data recovery across the whole network in the country. Where there is no information and it's white, either we are in the process of bringing this monitoring station for live reporting into SACWIS, or the monitoring station is in the process of being refurbished. And so these are the from across the monitoring stations. I will now give you an overview on what the data looks like when we look at it for the purpose of understanding the state of air quality. I'll focus on three particulates or three pollutants. Particulate matter, what we call PM10, which is large solid particles in the atmosphere, not visible to the naked eye. They are smaller than the human hair. They're very small particles, but they have impact on our health. Or the even smaller particles, the PM2.5, that are even smaller. And for those, they have impact on human health because they can be transferred down into the lungs and well into the bloodstream. Sulfur dioxide, which is a gas, and nitrogen dioxide, we will not present the nitrogen dioxide because for all the monitoring stations, there is compliance. I'll focus on the three pollutants. The air quality looks as this. At the bottom of the scale are the years since we have been monitoring. The different monitoring networks have got different trends because they were commissioned at different times by the different municipalities or provinces as such. At the bottom is the time period. Right above is the name of the monitoring station, and the names of the monitoring stations really depict the location. So focusing on Cape Town, for example, where we are in Bafokeng, is that we have monitoring stations in Bellevue South, for sure, and so forth. And they are representative of the area where we are monitoring. On the Y scale is the concentrations that we measure from that station. And is this what we are presenting to you is the annual average, because we've been monitoring at this station at this network for the past 12 years. The red line is the ambient air quality standard. So everything above the red line is in non-compliance with our own threshold. Below the red line shows compliance. I'll highlight Khayelitsha. It's in non-compliance. And Wallacedin is an area of concern. But you can also see that areas like Foshore, there have been seen significant improvements since the monitoring was initiated. So I'll move on very quickly to the next slide. And I think for colleagues, you can see Johannesburg, you can see the challenges. Set of 20, I'll move on quite quickly in the interest of time. And the private industries provide us with information, and we also use it to complement our measurements. So we have SASO, we have Richards Bay, Clean Air Association, and the next pollutant is sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide, we have seen compliance across the country at an annual, when we consider the annual averages. And across the whole country, you will see that this is the picture in terms of sulfur dioxide for the different locations. City of Tshwane has seen significant improvement in Pretoria West and Roslyn since the monitoring started. The Honourable Minister indicated that we have got three priority areas. The three priority areas are the Vowel Triangle, as you can see from this slide, in pink. In blue is the High Fold Priority Area, and in green is the Waterberg Bojanala Priority Area. We have dedicated monitoring in those areas because we have identified as priority areas, so they need special attention. These monitoring stations have been managed by the South African Weather Service, and they've given us consistent data in terms of the quality of air that we can start making decisions on. So from the three priority areas, Vowel Triangle has 6 monitoring stations, the High Fold has 5, Waterberg Bojanala has 4 monitoring stations. In the Vowel Triangle, you now understand why we have declared this as a priority area, or why the minister has declared this as a priority area. It's an area of concern with regard with particulate matter PM10. We have seen improvement in Deep Kloof and Sebokeng, but not so much in the other areas. The High Fold priority area, again, it's an area of concern, hence it is a priority area regarding PM10. The Waterberg Bojanala priority area, we have seen compliance in Lephalale, but not so in Mokopane and Xanadu in Tabazimbi. When we look at the slightly the smaller particles, the PM2.5, and we see the trend over the years since we have been monitoring, I will draw your attention to Deep Kloof and Sebokeng, where both of those locations have seen significant improvement that is not, although not reflected in the other monitoring station, can be attested to those two locations. The High Fold, there is non-compliance in most of the stations, except for in the past 3 years or so, MLO, Hedrina, and Middleburg. And they've shown consistent improvement of air quality in those areas. The Waterberg Bojanala, when you look at PM2.5, is Tabazimbi and Xanadu that are areas of concern. Regarding sulfur dioxide, there is clearly compliance with sulfur dioxide, consistent across, and this kind of information is interesting for us to see that even with the declaration, the sulfur dioxide concentrations in the ambient air have been consistently low in the Vowel Triangle. In the High Fold, we have seen improvement with sulfur dioxide in MLO, Hedrina, but we need to pay more attention to Witbank or Emalahleni area. In Waterberg Bojanala priority area, this is the area where we see the least matters in regarding sulfur dioxide. I've given you an overview on the annual concentrations. One of the things that we also try to understand is how do these concentrations vary with seasons and with time of the day. And what we have done on this plot is to show you how the pollutions vary between 12 o'clock in the midnight until 12 o'clock, and we plot the trend over this one day. Why is this information important? Because we need to understand, particularly where we see non-compliance, when are the concentrations the highest? And what we see that there is consistent highest concentrations during the winter period. And during the winter period, it's a combination of meteorology, high pressure systems. Every time we hear the term high pressure systems, we know that the high pressure system creates a lid in the atmosphere that traps pollution, so that in the High Fold in particular, you see that the pollution persists and persists for days until the cold front passes and the atmosphere clears. We also see that we have a peak in the morning and a peak in the afternoon, but not so much in the late afternoon. And this is important for us to understand when we alert the public, particularly when we use our app, to say during the day, the air is fine. In the morning and the afternoon, you have to take care because of the quality of air. I've presented the state of air quality. I've presented the monitoring results that we have since we've been monitoring across the whole country. We have some challenges that we have to highlight. One of the challenges that we have seen over the years is the issue of power failure. Our monitoring stations can only work with Eskom power. We cannot use solar panels because they can't provide us with sufficient power, and we can't use generators because the fumes from the generators who corrupt our measurements because they're also pollutants. So we have to use the ESCOM power to manage our mountain stations. When the power goes out, we lose data recovery. And in some cases, we can damage the instruments. We've also seen sporadic cases of vandalism and security risks on mountain stations. They are not prevalent, but we need to take care of them because they have started to occur in the past 3 or so months, something that we have not seen previously. We do have lack of capacity, as has been indicated by Mr. Senene, at the municipal level to manage most of the monitoring stations. And sometimes there is insufficient budget allocated for the maintenance of the monitoring stations. How does this reflect in terms of the statistics on those 136 stations? The slide on the right shows you the monitoring stations in the different provinces. What's in blue is where the number of monitoring stations. In green is the monitoring stations that are operational, and in red is those stations that are not operational. I'll bring your attention to Gauteng and KZN, where there is the largest number of monitoring stations. We are engaging with the municipalities, and we know that in the next few months, procurement processes for the provision of a service provider to manage the stations are at an advanced stage, and we know the stations will be coming online. There are also other interventions that we are putting in place. In terms of power failure, we have started installing on all the monitoring stations what we're calling uninterrupted power supply, which are those systems that will, UPS systems, that will allow the power when it trips, we do not get that surge that damages our equipment. We'll switch off our analyzers softly, and when the power comes back on, the UPS will allow the system to be switched on slowly, and we save our analyzers. Most of this equipment is imported. It's quite expensive, and we can't afford losses of equipment due to power failures and surges. And so this has been an effective tool that we have seen in the mountain station, hence the improvement in data recovery. We are also focusing on improving security. We are adding armed response on all the monitoring stations so that we improve the security of the monitoring station, and we are adding additional security, and we are trying installing cameras in the monitoring station so that as soon as the door is opened by anyone, the system, our circuits, will be alerting the technicians on someone has opened the door. And if the person is not the right person that are supposed to open the door, someone actions can be taken immediately. We are also improving capacity with municipalities. As we sit, the National Department is running a project where we are managing 43 stations as strategic stations across the country. 37 of them are government stations. We have taken over the management of those stations so that we can have a consistent reporting of data until 2022. And in the process, we are building capacity with the municipalities so that by the time this project is lapsed, the municipalities will have the capacity to take over the monitoring and manage the stations. We also have the interventions that we have put in place and we've seen it successful, where in terms of the priority area monitoring stations, the South African Weather Service has a consistent allocation of budget and management of the monitoring stations for the priority areas, and we have seen it's reaping results for us. This slide is just an indication to us to say of the monitoring stations that we have in the country, maintenance is a priority. The costs that we require across the whole country are significant, and it's an investment that we have put in as a country that we need to maintain for us to be reaping the rewards of getting the data that we are using for decision making. And lastly, we're also looking at other interventions. One of the things that we are doing is revisiting the technologies that we have put in place. We know that there are challenges and prohibitive costs in managing the monitoring stations because these are expensive assets and they need to be managed effectively, and if they break down, they have to be taken across the country, in some cases abroad to repair. So we are proposing that we need to maintain our network that we have, the 136 monitoring stations. However, in other places where we need to start monitoring in new areas, we need to consider the procurement of what are called low-cost sensors or low-cost devices, which require far less maintenance. They are really at a fraction of a cost. And we can purchase those, install in the areas where we're still missing monitoring. Only when we have seen that these low-cost sensors are giving us high levels of pollution, we then come in and bring in the expensive instruments to monitor compliance with ambient air quality standards. This approach is what has been used internationally because maintaining monitoring stations is an expensive exercise. And so filling in the gaps with low-cost sensors will allow us to maintain the compliance network as we need to, but we fill in the gaps with the much cheaper instruments that we can use for decision-making and screening purposes. Thank you for your attention.
we have come to the end. Now we'll take hands. The order will come from Honorable Singh, number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. Let's take that order. Number one.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to the Minister and colleagues, and thank you for the presentation. Very impressive, very colorful. But I think whilst we may have all this information, the greatest challenge is still going to be monitoring, compliance, evaluation. And I think your one slide number 60, on page 33, just sums it up when it comes to the challenges that you've identified. You know, I learned many, many years ago from my grandfather that most deaths are caused by the air you breathe and the food you eat. You know, so we've really got to, you know, we've got excellent laws, thank you for that, but whether we implement, whether we have the capacity to implement is a problem. I don't see in your presentation any reference to the Durban South or the South Durban Basin, and we know there that there are a lot of industries there, petrochemical industries and other industries. There have been lots of complaints, there have been studies in that area that the highest rate of cancer-related illnesses, particularly amongst children, this was 10 years ago, came from that area. And I would like to know to what extent is the 10 or 15-point plan that was developed between the Durban Metro, the province, and yourself is working. Because I was there on a site inspection a few weeks ago with one of the civil society organizations, and they were still very, very concerned on behalf of the community of what's happening in the Durban South Basin. Honorable Chairperson, the other thing is, you know, it's good to have all these monitoring stations, but how do the public know when it's dangerous? I know when I go home this evening, if I get a strong smell in the air, there's a factory not so far away from me, sulfur dioxide emissions are high, and I will call them. We have SOARS. SOARS falls under the department. Why can't we advertise the air pollution, the statistics on our TV channels? I know when I watch NDTV, which is an Indian channel sometimes, you see Delhi so many percent or whatever, Mumbai X. So the public are aware of what's happening, and not only that they can do something about it, but it also gets them to put pressure on the department at local, provincial, and national to do something about air quality in those areas. So can't we use that? Coal-fired power stations. What is the department going to do or doing to ensure that slowly but surely we get rid of coal-fired power stations? Because most of the air quality problems in Mpumalanga and all arise from this coal-fired. And Eskom is one of the biggest culprits. And we must not let Eskom get away because they are state-owned enterprise. They need to comply. Anywhere else in the world you go, there are industries, but there's less pollution because the industries are made to comply with legislation. And lastly, Chairperson, is the benchmark for new industries. Great. What about the older industries? Is there a time frame for them to say within a year you must get X, Y, and Z sorted out? Otherwise, you know, you're going to be in trouble. And then the relationship between national, provincial, and local, how strong is it? Do we have resources to capacitate local? Local government can't even cope with providing basic services to our people. You know, are they going to look at these areas here? And if we put a lot of emphasis on them being able to sort the problems out at that level, it's not going to happen. So we've got to be realistic about it. So I'd just like to hear some responses later on. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, everyone. I have a couple of questions. The first question is that we all know that Eskom and Sasol has applied to extend their compliance till 2025. I would like to know who is responsible for that decision and if they will adhere to it. The question related to that is, since 2010, it was clear that they knew about this, and I read an article the other day where the CEO of Eskom actually just said, "We're throwing up our hands. We have done nothing. We just don't. We we haven't done anything. They need 300 billion rand in order to do this. And then my question is, what did they do with the money that was given to them from 2010 until now? Because my opinion is equality did not improve, although we say it did. And it seems they're increasing and it just keeps on going. It's almost like they've given up. So where is the consequences from the department into either fining them or jailing them? I've read the other day the air quality program of Eskom, which two of the main things is they have to keep their license to operate, and the second one is to really comply to this zero harm policy of them in order for them to do not do harm to the ecology and people's wealth. But they're clearly not doing it, and the fine for that is 10 million rand or 10 years in jail. Then my second question is, on Tuesday, someone said, sir, yeah, everyone says the monitoring facilities is operating, but we were told actually on Tuesday, that was one of my questions, the monitoring stations are actually vandalized. They're actually not useful at this stage because they have been vandalized. So it's maybe harsh to say they're not useful, but they really can't do what they're supposed to do because of the vandalism. Then my next question is, last year the previous minister applied for SO2 emissions to be actually increased, and it was stopped because of public participation. That same request went through this year, as I believe it is still open. If not, is it closed? And what public participation process was taking place? When was it taking place? Where it was taking place? And if in Eskom Air Compliance they actually wanted to reduce SO2 with 18%, why is it that they're actually requesting increasing SO2? This specifically, I am at Creel, which we all know now globally has been identified as the second highest SO2 emissions in the country. And South Africa is actually seventh overall regarding this. My question is, I do find it strange, I understand the thinking that responsibility seems to go to local government, and yes, we train people, and yes, we really try to get people informed, but I come from the Nkangala District Municipality, I live in the HPA area, where an official makes a decision on giving a license. Why is that responsibility not with the Department of Environmental Affairs? And because to me it's a big, too big decision to make, and it's a globally big decision to make. And then my question is, has this person been trained? What is his experience, and to what level does he have that responsibility? I think I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the very informative presentation. On Tuesday, we were told that only 53 of the 98 monitoring stations met the minimum data recovery of 70% for sulfur dioxide pollutants, and 31 of 87 monitoring stations met the minimum data recovery of 70% on PM10 pollutants. This means that we weren't getting reliable data on national air quality. Yeah, on Tuesday. So I'm looking, I'm looking at the monitoring reports for Etiquini. I come from KwaZulu-Natal, and just like my colleague, Mr. Singh, Honorable Singh, we have a huge problem in the South Durban Basin, and I see that a lot of the monitors that fall within the South Durban Basin are not producing any data, or the data seems to be unreliable. I know there are studies that are being commissioned by the University of KwaZulu-Natal because of the incidence of cancer, as he has previously mentioned, as well as respiratory illness. What I want to know is, where is the monitoring station in those areas, where is the data going? Who is collecting the data? How is it being used? How is it being communicated to the communities in the area? The emissions from the petrochemical and waste management industries in the basin, is the municipality collaborating with industry on emissions? Who's enforcing compliance? Have we held anyone to task when they've been non-compliant with norms and standards? Has there been a precedent set in the past? Or have industry been allowed to act unfettered without any monitoring compliance at the expense of our communities? And for how long has this been going on? How long have these stations not been working and providing reliable data for? And what are we going to do as a department? As we say, the municipality doesn't seem to have capacity, enforcement, nor will. And our people are dying. And it's just not good enough anymore. We need a solid plan of action. If there's intervention required from this department and provincially, then it is something that we need to address with a sense of urgency. We can no longer afford to drag our heels. All right, and then with regards to the pollution in our hotspots, are we aware of whether or not is it solely Eskom or is it private polluters? Do we know what percentage of each? And what the most serious pollutants are, both in the Highveld and in the Meerbank area? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the warm welcome. Aljama positions itself as an environmental political party. And we have been very active, especially in Khayelitsha and Mashupumalele, with regard to the air pollution. And we are at war with the Department of Environmental Affairs. We feel they've let the country down, and they have not carried out their mandate. With regard to that, we have obtained 3 directives from the Director of Environmental Enforcement in our favor. We've received a settlement award from the Public Protector and horrific findings of the neglect by the Department of Environmental Affairs as far as their investigation is concerned. Mr. Chairman, we also very disappointed that Khayelitsha is not one of the 3 priority areas. We work with the top guns in environment at the 3 universities in Cape Town, and we get satellite imagery from someone who has a satellite in Argentina. So we're very clued up on air toxins. And we want to share with you, Mr. Chairman, one of the sources and the effects of the neglect by the Department of Environmental Affairs on air pollution quality. You know, Mr. Chairman, poorly treated sewerage that enter our waterways and land up in the ocean, the algal bloom that it stabilizes gives toxins that pollute the air, and some of the toxins are poisonous and non-poisonous. We already heard that Khayelitsha is non-compliant, and a million residents of Khayelitsha are dying a slow death. And one of the honorable members mentioned about cancer, respiratory illnesses. So the municipalities hide behind the fact that there are no regulations. We want to enforce the NEMA Act, as one of the honorable members has said, and start jailing officials of the Department of Environmental Affairs, the Western Cape Department, and the municipalities for the neglect, and they must rot in jail for 10 years. That is the aim of our party. So I want to make it quite clear that we are not impressed with the urgency and what we've heard today that is given to sorting out the air pollution. Mr. Chairman, it has an effect on the national health of the country. Every week, people have to go see doctors for antibiotics. Just imagine what effect this will have on the National Health Insurance Act. People develop antibodies, they build up resistance to these toxins, and we nearly had a situation in December this year where the examination of the toxins in the air was nearly poisonous. Not that we wanted it to be poisonous and people to die, but we felt that that will shake the Department of Environmental Affairs, it will shake the municipalities, and our political party has taken a position that Parliament mustn't delegate these sensitive matters to the provinces or the municipalities. They first have to fix it themselves. We have managed, Mr. Chairman, to get in one room the green scorpions, the blue scorpions, the municipality officials. We got the National Environment Department to fly up the officials to explain to them what we're explaining to this portfolio committee. We didn't have much success at that meeting in Cape Town. We hope now that we're going to use Parliament to save the nation and to help save this part of the planet. Because our air pollution, we have green scorpions, we've got blue scorpions, but we've got lame ducks looking after our air pollution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Number five.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I just want to congratulate the department for an excellent presentation. I think now I've got clarity on what they have been doing as the department, of which it's a lot that has been done. And I think we must know that this belongs to the three spheres of government, not the national only. But I just want to say those industries that are polluting, that are the polluters, remember there's the issue of the polluter pays. Have you handled those issues that they need to pollute to make sure that they don't affect, their pollution doesn't affect their nearby residents? When you look at the OHS Act, it says you must protect also, as an employer, protect your employees plus the visitors from any pollution that emanates from your working area, a working environment. I think it's high time that they must be, we must pin them down. Then the other thing is that, have you also thought of using the OHS labor inspectors to prohibit such institutions? They prohibit them for a certain period until they comply. They meet a certain minimum requirement, then they reopen. But it's being reopened by the labor OHS inspectors. I'm just trying to figure out that you need to use other departments in order to achieve some of your goals. You've done an excellent job. The other thing is the awareness campaigns. We need, as a department, please tell us how far are you, because this is very important. People need to know, those who are educated and those who are uneducated, what are the consequences? Because sometimes people, they assume, and it's a wrong assumption. The other thing I'm talking about, have you also looked at Salga, COCTA, and COCTA to intervene on the issue of municipalities? Because usually I know Salga, they have a meeting with all the municipalities where they report on all those issues. Look at those issues if they can assist you. The issue of coal also, it's a problem. And it's one of the polluters, of the main polluters. Have you also looked at how you can try to intervene that the communities where they use coal, they try and use the gas? Although gas is expensive, it will go with awareness. I'm saying that because it was once done in maybe that's why Pretoria West is compliant with the administration of the ANC. They supply the two-plate gas stove with the cylinders so that they reduce the coal usage. Maybe that's why I see now it went down. If you can look at that with other departments also, including the municipality. Then the other thing is that let's also, I'm requesting the department, utilize the Department of Health. When their whole promoters are doing their health promotion work, let them create awareness and let them also, the departments, request them if they can do the screening on those areas where there's too much concentration of air pollution, just to reduce the health effects and monitor if really those people that are sick, because sometimes you'll end up being blamed for something that doesn't belong to you, just to check if really is it the government that is responsible for this or not. Then my worry is the other thing is that the rural areas. You talk of the urban areas, but what about the rural areas? Because we find that these industries, sometimes they are being, when they apply for licensing, they are being placed far away from the urban areas, of which there are communities there that end up being affected. Let's also see how it can be assisted. And then the other thing, your equipment is much modified now. But what I'm saying, have you also think of other, how you assist the municipalities? Because I know that you have staff that are assisting the municipalities on awareness. Have you thought of placing at least staff that can assist on the air pollution control? Because before, the air pollution control station was usually put in an EHP's office. Have you looked at how you can assist to make sure that the staffing, like you have done with the awareness? That's my take. Thank you.
Number six.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also follow suit and thank the department for their presentation. Chair, I only have one point. We know that Sasol is one of the biggest companies that are adding in air pollution. I just want to ask if they are complying in terms of Air Quality Act. If not, what is it that the department is doing? Because we seem to focus only on Eskom and forgetting about these big companies that are also adding on this air pollution, Chair. Secondly, Chair, I want to also emphasize on the issue of the awareness that has been also raised by my colleague Mbata to the communities that are situated around those areas. We also, as the department, they need to intensify those awarenesses. Thank you, Chair.
We're still on time, but might easily slide into being behind. Can we get a response, Honourable?
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think where we need to start is with the Constitution, because the Constitution places the responsibility for enforcement with the municipalities. And the Constitution, in doing this, also provides resources for the municipalities, because you would understand that businesses that receive licenses pay municipalities for those licenses. So I think it would be entirely appropriate for this committee to call the City of Cape Town, the City of eThekwini, and any other city, and ask them why they are struggling to enforce. And I think you can then decide whether you would advise our department to do more capacity building or you would want to beat up the municipalities for non-compliance. I think that that is a very important function that the portfolio committee has. And I think that what you can see is that in situations where there is a perception by the public, by industry and by municipalities that there are eyes on the situation, you can see that there are improvements. So I think the portfolio committee must undertake its work and must call the municipalities here to explain what they are doing to implement their constitutional power. It's not my power. And it's not a power that has been allocated in terms of law. If it were a power that was allocated in terms of law, I could take it away. As it is, you will have to see if you get a two-thirds majority in order to change the constitution and give me that power. Because at the moment, I don't have it. So I think you must hold those who have the power responsible for implementing their functions. The second thing I would want to say is that I think it's also important that you call those whom you perceive to be the big polluters before the committee to explain why they're not complying and what their plans are to comply. I think that's very important. So whether it's in the Durban Basin or whether it's in Cape Town or whether it's on the Mpumalanga Highveld, you have your own views as to who is causing the problem. Call them before the committee and allow them to explain to the committee what are their particular problems. I think that's very important. We support the idea that there should be more public education around this. I would be the last person who would want to be saying that people who use coal-fired stoves and so on because it's cheaper than other forms of heating and cooking, I would be the last person to want to blame them for their own situations. But I think that we do know that in many instances those appliances are causing the particulate matter pollution. And we also know that in many situations those appliances are actually not just discharging into the air. They are actually discharging particulate matter into the homes. So I think that public education is helpful, but I think public education always would have to go with solutions, and perhaps it's something that honourable members must think about. What can those solutions be? Because we all know that the fiscus is under strain, and whatever solutions we come up with, the public will have to pay for those solutions. So I think that this question doesn't require drama. It requires serious consideration because there is no doubt that part of the problem with particulate matter is a domestic problem. So how do we assist people to understand that and how do we assist them to mitigate that situation in situations where people are in dire economic situations themselves? Titi, you'll explain what the public participation process around the SOX has been, but we haven't yet made a decision on that matter. I think that the question that the honourable members may want to explore further is the issue of the Eskom power stations, particularly that fleet that some of which are due for retirement. So we all understand that we have a commission of inquiry that is looking into some of the things that went wrong in state-owned enterprises. And we don't need to air that issue further here. The question that we've now got to consider is, do we retrofit those power stations? And if we retrofit them, what do we retrofit them with? And is the taxpayer prepared to pay for it? Because in the end, that retrofitting is going to become the responsibility of those of us who purchase electricity. Because we know that every time there is capital expenditure, ultimately it impacts on the price of electricity. So these are the very difficult questions that we've got to consider. Through the Green Fund, we have raised money for the retrofitting of Medupi with the flue gas desulfurization equipment. That is the state-of-the-art equipment, and that is the equipment that will get the sulfates below the 500 level. We still have to look at a similar process for Kusile. But I think the honourable members must apply their minds to what do we do about the others. Because this technology is expensive. And in the end, it is going to be, I myself doubt that it's 300 billion rand. I think that is an exaggeration. The flue gas desulfurization plant in Medupi did not cost 300 billion. So I think we must take 300 billion off the table. That's not what this technology costs. Digi, I'm sure you have somewhere in your mind an understanding of what is the Medupi costing. So we can share that with you. But it's definitely not 300 billion. That's apocryphal. I think that what we would then have to consider, because in the end, colleagues, we are policymakers, and the question we have to consider is, can we further burden the taxpayer on retrofitting the old power stations? This is a discussion which we need to have. And I would be interested in your advice on this matter. Because I think that ultimately it pertains to this question of at what level do you put the sulfuric emissions level. I think what's very important to explain to the committee that at the moment in the problem areas, the sulfur levels are, as you saw from the Greenpeace study, approaching somewhere in the region of 3,500. So if you were to set it at 1,000 and you were to enforce it vigorously, it would be a considerable improvement. The question is, does it help to have it at 500 and you don't have the technology that can bring it to that level? And I think honourable members must debate and discuss this issue and must debate and discuss whether you would be advising the Minister of Public Enterprises that he should retrofit the old power stations with the flue gas technology. Member Singh, I think that the whole issue of coal-fired power stations, what we all understand is that South Africa at the moment is 88% of South Africa's energy comes from coal-fired power stations. So we are looking forward to the new integrated resource plan because that will be setting better benchmarks in terms of renewables. And we look forward to the Minister of Energy releasing that because that certainly would be guiding on the way forward. I think the key issue that we would want to be addressing now in terms of the carbon gas So the carbon gas is different from these other things. And in my understanding, there's no such thing as burning coal without carbon gas. You can reduce the SOx and the NOx, but you can't reduce the carbon when you burn coal. So the issue around the carbon really relates to this thing of the just transition. And that is the mechanism that we are wanting to work on at national government at this point, is to how do you start transitioning from an 88% dependency on coal to a different energy mix, and how do you ensure that those who are currently employed in the coal generation sector have alternate forms of employment. So that is what the just transition is all about. And the job summit last year talked about setting up a presidential climate change commission, and one of the key purposes of that commission would be to oversee the just transition so that you can move to a different energy mix, you can have the appropriate skills, but you're not throwing hundreds of thousands of people into the street. Gigi, can I hand over to you to deal with this issue of the SO2 emissions? What was the public participation process? And then the issue of data recovery and data reliability. I think the other issues have been, by and large, dealt with.
Thank you, honourable members. The question that was raised, or at least what we presented in the report that was tabled before the committee on Tuesday, referred to the fact that we have a target for data recovery, which is that all the stations should be operational, at least with data recovery of about 75%. And where you had that slide showing, I was looking at Westrand, for example, we have those yellow blocks which indicate in those areas that we're below 75%. We're at 67, 68, 71, but it does not mean that data was not useful in terms of informing the state of the air. We set a standard so that we make sure that all of these stations are operational at a level above 75%. So there is no misleading to the committee. That was the state that we were reporting on, and we're then giving the reasons why in those areas we had lower data recovery. And the slide that was explaining some of the challenges around vandalization and some of the challenges related to power supply and other reasons that are linked to those stations being not reliable at above 75%. And we then also, Ms. Magwaza, when she was presenting, said that in those areas where we have white blocks, so I was indicating the green and the orange, in those areas, those stations are not even giving us data. And those are the stations that we do not have maintenance in most of the municipalities, or others require full repair or full replacement. And those are the ones that are not on stream in terms of a simple explanation. So that's the state, and therefore we have not misled the honorable members in that respect. And then the second question that the minister has asked me to respond to, as minister has already explained the issue of the technology for sulfur dioxide, our ambient air quality standard is sitting at 500, and the discussions which were linked to the postponement applications, because all new plants are able to meet that standard. That's why minister was giving the example. For example, in the case of Eskom with Medupi, because it's a new plant, they have to meet the new standard. the old plant, whether it's krill, whether it's any other plant, or even sasol, they have presented, because the reason why we had the postponement provision for old plants, we wanted to have an understanding whether technologically they can be able to meet the required new standards. On particulate matter, we think we are convinced, I think scientifically, and the engineers that are working in this area have confirmed that it is possible. But with sulfur dioxide, for old plants, especially those that are approaching retirement, the question was whether you want to give them other options of flexibility of technologies, because 500 milligrams or micrograms would only at least be retrofitted with a flue gas technology. So we're wanting to give them the options based on the scientific work that was presented. So the regulation or the standard that was published at the time was then considering that option, but as the Honourable Member correctly spelled out or explained, we had that those regulations had to be set aside because we did not follow appropriate or fully the public participation process. And now they were put out in public, and again we are going to get to a point where the Minister should be put in a position to make a decision based on what comes out of the public participation process. So they were republished, they were withdrawn initially after they were set aside, and then we then started the process again, but there is no decision on those regulations yet. And Minister, technologies, we avoid talking about prices because we are not sellers or promoters of technology. But for sure, we did have an engagement with Eskom. At the time, we were saying, even because they had 600 and something billion, they went down to 300. But they said billion. That was they came to the committee, not this committee, in the previous round. And we then had a process of engaging them on the costs. But I don't have that full information with me now, but that information, in our assessment, we know exactly what was paid for Medupi on flue gas technology. And for the old plants, if they have to retrofit all of them, then they had, they would work out the average cost based on that, in those millions of rand per station, because it's going to be retrofitted in each plant if they want to continue operating them beyond 2025. So that's where we are with the regulations on public participation. And then lastly, Honourable Members, the other questions the Minister has already confirmed around public awareness and to deal with the issues of indoor pollution. We have regulations that are supposed to protect communities and interventions that are also part of the discussions, especially in the high priority areas, because there was a study that confirmed that, in fact, it is not only about the industrial emissions. There is a lot that we need to do to manage the indoor pollution. And Eskom at some point had a rebate program also to help communities to move away from coal stoves or coal burning, but that program did not continue, and the Department of Energy would be best placed to confirm whether they can still make that investment or not. And partnerships with SALGA, we have a memorandum of understanding. Minister, through MINMEX, SALGA participates, and also COCTA, we have a technical committee and a ministerial committee that deals with basic services, and these matters are always on the agenda, but municipalities are still not having sufficient capacity. So the National Department, even if we had all, we don't have the resources to support all municipalities. We have reprioritized budgets to try and make the investments in technology and maintenance in areas where we've been able to, but we have a limit to how far we can go, even in that respect. So those are the questions, I think, that were remaining. Thank you, Honourable Member.
get that.
Thank you, Jay. I just would like to ask the public participation if there's a schedule where, when, and how, and if it can be circulated to us so we can be aware in which areas and what times and when, please. Thank you very much.
We'll provide information about the trust on the public participation. Thanks.
We don't want to run behind schedule. We must now get to item number 4, briefing by the department on the roadmap for the eradication of asbestos waste. Disposal.
Mediation. And I think that what honourable members would understand is that asbestos has been outlawed as a building material. South Africa is a signatory to various international conventions, and the last asbestos mines were closed down in the 1990s. But we have been left as a country with a legacy of asbestos pollution, both in terms of former mines, and I would plead with colleagues that we don't go into that issue today, because if you want to deal with that issue, you need to deal with the Department of Mineral Resources, who are responsible for the rehabilitation of mines. But we also have a situation where we have asbestos material inside many private and public buildings. So we have homes where roofs and ceilings were made out of asbestos. We have schools and clinics where the entire structure was made out of asbestos. And we also have situations in some communities where you will find even roads that would have been paved with asbestos material. So there was a decision taken by Cabinet following a study into the secondary pollution that there needs to be remediation. And what is going to be presented today is the progress with that. What honourable members will understand is that the big difficulty in this area is that there's a whole range of line function departments that would need to be remediating in their own space. And so I suppose the key question that you would be wanting to ask the panel, the colleagues, is less about what those departments haven't done and why, because you would need to ask them. But I guess the key question you would want to ask them is, why are they struggling to coordinate? Because I think that one can say at the outset that this is not a happy presentation.
No, you can present.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. honourable members, honourable minister, DG, DDGs and colleagues. My name is Michelle Govender. I'm from the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries, and I'm the chief director responsible for hazardous waste management and waste licensing. With me, I have Dr. Mpochi Tangoni, who is the director of land remediation and the project manager, ensuring that the projects that we carry out as a department are done so effectively and efficiently when it comes to asbestos remediation. There are some technical issues, and our presentations are not, unfortunately, being projected, but I think you have the presentations with you, and I'll proceed in that regard. Now, just as a minister's given us a very nice introduction, but I just want to go back and indicate that asbestos is a naturally occurring material. It's a mineral, and we had an abundant amount of this across the country, and it was exposed through mining operations in four provinces in particular, and these were the Mpumalanga, Northern Cape, Limpopo, and Northwest provinces. Now, the reason asbestos was so looked into was because of how durable it was. It was used in a variety of products. It was used in textiles, in cement products, in blocks, in bricks, and other uses like your brake pads in your cars. Because of the cooling mechanism that it had, it was very much supported. And like Minister said, is that the commercial mining in this country has been happening for decades. In fact, it started around 1910, so it's been going on for a long time. But those mines were closed in 1997. When public outcry and public became really affected by the asbestos exposure, and people were, getting sick. So, but the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, as Minister had said, was responsible for the mines, and they have a rehabilitation program which they are implementing. But they did not focus on the villages around the mining areas. So maybe at this point I'd like to explain what secondary asbestos contamination is. So the primary contamination would occur in the mines for the miners that are actually working with this. But when the asbestos was mined, it was removed to villages where it was processed and milled. And those processing facilities were not rehabilitated or remediated, and that fibers being exposed caused people to be affected by that, and that was our focus area because these were not in the mines themselves but in areas around the mines. Now, in 2004, Cabinet tasked the department to do an assessment to look at exactly what the extent of asbestos contamination was in the country. And this study was done in 2006, and it showed different levels of contamination in the four provinces that I mentioned. Now, following this study, the department developed a plan called the Secondary Asbestos Remediation Plan, and we also developed a costing model that went with that plan. And one of the things that I need to emphasize is part of that secondary asbestos remediation report that was developed, there was a social impact assessment done which showed that there were two particular areas in those provinces. This was Khamopedi in the Northern Cape and Mshushu in the Limpopo provinces that were significantly affected by asbestos contamination. At this point, I want to indicate that there is a policy framework behind this remediation of contaminated land. We've got Part 8 of the National Environmental Management Waste Act of 2008, which makes provision for remediation of contaminated land. And this legislation, or this Part 8, it applies to contamination that occurred even before the Act came into effect. So basically the act is retrospective. And so through this act, we can identify areas that are contaminated. We can test to determine or confirm the actual contamination, and then provision can be made for this land to be remediated. The next slide is an indication, it's a chronology of what has already happened. So the Portfolio Committee then in 1996 were very instrumental in bringing to light or bringing this information to the public that there were many asbestos-related problems affecting communities. And the Portfolio Committee actually visited these areas in 97, and a summit on this matter held in 1998, which eventually led to the banning of mining activities within the country in the 90s, as Minister has said. And because of this public outcry and because of the emphasis placed on this, the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy have been shutting down these mines from that time until 2002. Cabinet was then instructed us to develop this remediation plan, which we did, and a costing model, and it was approved in 2013. Now, between 2013 and 2017, you would understand, honorable members, that in order for us to implement the plan, it requires a lot of money. And we had applied for and gotten a small amount of money as the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries, which we used to remediate streets and roads in the communities of Penj and Mafefe or Mshushu in the Limpopo province. We rebuilt a school in the Mafefe village. We did some work on containing these asbestos fibers within sports grounds in Khamopedi in the Northern Cape. But there are a large number of roads across these two provinces that still require action to be undertaken. And as we go forward, we will then review the work that we've done and improve on the plans and the coordination with regard to obtaining funds to remediate. Just as a summary, there were the major departments involved here would be the Department of Basic Education, Department of Labor, Department of Agriculture, Human Settlements, the Department of Transport, and the local municipalities within the Northern Cape and Limpopo provinces. Now, as Minister said, we need to understand what the progress has been made, and I've indicated that funding is what we need to be able to implement this project. The Northern Cape province has committed a total of $1.5 million for this remediation. The Department of Education rebuilt a school, the Kiba School in the Northern Cape. The Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs rebuilt a tribal council building in the Limpopo province. And other departments are still to confirm their financial commitment to this, to the implementation of the secondary asbestos remediation plan. As I have indicated, the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy do have a rehabilitation plan, and we need to understand exactly how far they've gone in their projects or in their funding. Now, as a department, what we will do moving forward is we'll review that secondary asbestos plan. We will try and unblock those obstacles that are at the moment stopping us or limiting us to access funding to really give effect to remediation in the Limpopo and Northern Cape provinces. We will look at once those asbestos fibers are collected or contained, do we need to dispose of materials and where do we need to dispose, as at the moment asbestos is pre-classified as a type 1, which is a highly hazardous material and can only go to certain landfill sites. We're really looking at a mechanism where we can dispose of this safely and to ensure that the community is protected. We are also, as Minister had indicated, we are identifying barriers to compliance to those asbestos management laws, and we need to have a cooperative model between the various stakeholders, which we are working on at the moment, and we need to start looking at sustainable agricultural practices in and around these areas. So that, in a nutshell, Honourable Chair, is what we're doing currently on this.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I'm looking at your hands, but before you, I think what is critical, if there's, I think we also want to learn, if a decision is taken by cabinet, I don't know what is expected from the officials to do, to implement, because we can't have decisions everywhere. So if cabinet take a decision, it took a decision in 2013, there must have been some plan of action. If it collapses, somebody must account for that. That's why we are here. So I think what is critical is accounting about why we all agree this asbestos is trouble for the people. Now we all, a decision gets taken with our advice, and after a decision has been taken, we expect it to be implemented. In fact, I always have problems with the officials who talk like consultants. They would say, there's no funding. If you give us money, we'll do it. And whilst other things get done. So I think generally we would want that. We would want to make a sense. Well, it can't be everybody. When we go to communities to ask for votes, they don't tell us about a remedial action that can't be implemented. When they die, we go to their funerals, we talk there. We must say condolences. And when we know that there are certain things that would be causes. So generally, I think DG and your team, a minister, is on our side this time. He should be. She is the one who should be asking you in your boardrooms, why do we take a decision as cabinet and the decision is not implemented? Then there must be consequences. Otherwise, if we do things as we do, then there will be no government. Madiba once said, people can give you explanations, but they will not remove the challenge. An explanation, you can't beat an explanation. If people die and their decision has been taken, so one would say, I'm prefacing, honorable members, your comments, your questions, and whatever. But I think the message must go out clear. If a cabinet takes a decision, we expect that to be implemented. If not implemented, well, I would say an explanation. We'll listen to the explanation. But if it can't take us forward, then we'd definitely say minister action. Honorable members, Honorable Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I can't agree with you more that we've got to hold cabinet accountable, and that is through the member of the executive that is here. and I think as a portfolio committee we take this quite seriously, because in 2008 this announcement was made. I know it was a few months before the election. Whether it was an electioneering announcement or whether it was an announcement that really they wanted to implement in terms of protecting the lives of communities. So hopefully we can get some report back, you know, after Minister engages with Cabinet. Secondly, I think we need to write to Department of Minerals and Energy as a committee to find out how are they progressing with this rehabilitation program. It's many, many years. What are they doing? What's the action plan? And even if we have to engage our colleagues in that portfolio committee, we must do that. And I think it's quite ironic, if you go to our parks where we live, well, I live in Acacia Park, you know, I think there are buildings there with asbestos. I know one of my members has been complaining for a long time with asbestos roofs. So right where we are, exposed to public works providing us homes with asbestos roofs. I think it's something that we have to check. You and colleagues around next week check. But I'm pretty sure that there are homes with asbestos roofs. So to what extent, you know, the ban is probably for new people coming online, but what about existing structures? And there are a few mentioned here, which is very good, under funding commitments. But how much more is being done and needs to be done in this regard? These are good examples, but I think we need to, somebody needs to do some kind of survey to check on, you know, buildings with asbestos roofs, et cetera, and make the public in those areas aware of the dangers of asbestosis in particular. Thank you, Chair.
No, the whip first.
Thank you, Chair. I thought out of respect you have chosen, or perhaps age, you have chosen Honorable Mbatha first. Thank you very much, Chair. Quite frankly, I do not feel this presentation. I think we must appreciate that we are a new portfolio committee member. Now, I thought this department would take us through who's who, doing what. You don't assume that we have interfaced with the reports of the previous portfolio committee, and at this juncture we're already inclined with the dynamics of this particular department. But I had expected a bit more. But let me quickly go to slide 6. Check in page 3, the secondary asbestos remediation. Now the plan there starts in 1996. Now a child who was born in 1996 has a degree today. He's 23 years old. He's 23 years old. So the plan, I'm not getting a sense. How far are we? Is there progress? Are we going forward? Are we stuck? And the chief director there speaks about funding, but we are not taking through how much do we need. When you draft the plan, you must have financial projections. How much did we need? How much did we get? And how much did we use? And what did we use it for? Because in slide 7, she says there they've built a school. They've paved a Gamopedi primary. I mean, really, there are no details there. You've paved a, how long? How long is this pavement? Is it 20 meters? Is it 100 meters? I'm not getting the gist. I think this presentation needs a bit of meat. In slide 8, she identifies the stakeholders there. What are the roles of basic education? The building of a school is the responsibility of Department of Education. The Department of Agriculture, the Department of Labor, all those departments that are identified there, what are their roles? Because you can't just say these are the stakeholders involved and you leave it at that. What is it that they are involved in? We must be taken through. There's a numbered slide there. I want to assume it's slide number 9. It says the Northern Cape Department of Environment has committed a total of 1.5 million for secondary asbestos remediation. Is it committed only? Has it been delivered? If it has been delivered, what is it that it has been used for? How much is left? I'm just saying, Che, can we be taken serious, man? I'm not feeling this presentation. Thanks, Che.
Thank you, Che. Firstly, I would say, as a committee, let's give the department the format or what we need in their presentation, because really it's going to take us back that we query. And now I believe that if you give somebody a format to say this is what I would expect you to report, but I just want to say that asbestos is one of the hazardous substances, and it's been there for years, and it will take time to remedy it, to make sure that it's eliminated totally. Remember, it's a rock that is with the fiber that is natural. It's a natural resource. So what I want to know, I can see, because the remedial action will take, it's not going to be a short term. It's going to be long, and I can see that you've put it in what has been happening since 1996, because it needs to be a follow-up, continuous, until it's fully done with all the relevant stakeholders. But I don't see you involving the mines, the actual people who were doing the mining, because they are supposed to rehabilitate those mines and make for a certain period of years that rehabilitation, so that, because sometimes there's climate change and then there's heavy rains, they remove everything, but they must make sure that they come back. But it's not your responsibility alone with the mineral and energy. I will come back to say, let's make sure that all the relevant stakeholders, they take part in assisting us. I know the Mafefe in Limpopo. When we are talking about the community, I know they used to go to the old mine dumps and take the rock with asbestos and inhale it, make sure that they get infected because they want to be compensated. Mm. Hence, we need awareness in those areas, in those villages, that these stones are very, these fibers are highly infectious. The kids, everyone, they must stay away from them. Let alone the compensation money, because they are looking at money, but they were not looking at their health. So this is the first thing. And also, if those fibers are still there, those miners, the mining company, must pay. Make sure you pin them down. And I'm still saying that you are not the implementer. The implementers, you are the policy makers. Make sure that you work hand in glove with the implementers, that they do the actual implementation. Sometimes I feel for the national department, because at the end we are not the implementer. But make sure that you pin down those people. You've got policies that you can use from your side, and because it's hazardous substances, use the Occupational Health and Safety Act also, and utilizing the OHS, labor OHS inspectors to assist you. Please also, let's get the statistics of the people who are affected in those areas based on asbestos infection. If we can have that and see how can we assist.
I know there were mines around the areas who would say, for this I can give so much money back to the community to make sure that there's some awareness and all these things with prizes to the schools and so forth. Where are those activities? Let those activities come back, because in real life, asbestos, we still have it everywhere. The Black Township, the roofing is asbestos. Everywhere is asbestos. In the DBW government buildings, there's still asbestos. And also, can you utilize? There's an national institute. It's in Joburg, not far from the Wits University. Please utilize there. We have researchers, we have expertise there, occupational hygienists, all type of these people, of specialized people that can assist you as the department, because they are the national department. They are there to assist you, including the indoor quality. They are there to assist them. Please utilize them so that in next time you can give us more information. But to me, my colleagues my they need more information. But if you read this, it shows that in each and every year, like you have written here, there's something that you have done. It shows something, but there's some lack of other things like I have mentioned. Please go and look at it and collaboration with other departments. And next time, please, even the air quality, tell us how do you pin down the polluters. They have the role to make sure that they correct their wrongs. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine will also be on the slide 9, where it talks about other departments to confirm financial commitment. What I'd like to find out is if they, at the end of the day, committed. And the other thing that I want to mention is that I am from the Northern Cape. Hamupedi is not even 10 kilometers from where I'm staying. What I'm asking myself is if it is mentioned in the presentation that in order to deal with asbestos, a school was paved. I'm just asking myself as to how that then assisted the community where asbestos is visible on the ground and even in the water that the community is using for household and for their livestock. The other area, it is not only Hamopedi that is affected by asbestos in the John Taolo Gaetsewe municipality, if I can mention. There are areas like Tine, where you don't seek for asbestos, but you see it on the ground, you see it in the water when you want to go and fetch the water and drink or give to your animals. I think that's all that I wanted to say.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to make a proposal that I want to concur with Honorable Modise, that at least we get a comprehensive report or presentation with all these things that the honorables have highlighted. Also, I want to propose that by Wednesday, I want to give them a time frame, that we receive that report, even if we get a soft copy, it be emailed to us. Thank you, I wanted to make that proposal.
I think you are now going to respond. I think out of the comments by the members, you can pick a sense that there's a gap on our part in terms of we're looking at the years, say 1996. Now it's 2019. So there's a gap for us. So even what you call this remedial action, it implies that there must have been a plan. So some people must have gone through that plan. It might be outdated now. So you said you want to review it. I suspect we want to be together with you in that process. Understand, are we serious? Maybe now it's no longer an issue, this thing of asbestos. If it is an issue, do we want to deal with it, and how and when? So I'm saying as we respond, so that we don't just talk generally. Honorable Minister.
I think, Chair, let me suggest the following to the committee. I'm sure if there was a plan that had been implemented, you would have heard about it today. So let's accept that you've given us a beating. We take the beating. What I want to suggest is that we need to allow the officials to go back. They need to go back and meet with the sister departments, and they need to develop a credible plan. You won't have it by Wednesday. I think you need to be realistic. So let's accept the beating. Let's not try and spin the committee. Let's go away and bring a credible plan that is implemented to put before the committee to monitor. That's my suggestion.
No, that's a good summary of even the questions that were being asked. We might end up even disagreeing amongst ourselves because she has got experience of this problem in the Northern Cape, in North theory. Honorable Singh talked about Acacia Park. So I'm saying all those, it's a challenge that we may not avoid, especially for me. I'm quite serious. When a cabinet takes a decision, I expect officials to run with that. Because otherwise, there's no need of government if we can sit and take decisions and they are not implemented. All officials should take cabinet decisions seriously. So that's where I agree with the minister. That's the beating. And the beating then says there must come a credible plan that can take us on board as well to understand what are we going to monitor. Because our duty is to monitor implementation of laws, of whatever, execution of such. So that's all we are about. So I would take that as summarizing, closing this item so that you can. But before that, you want to say something. Okay.
Yes, Jay, thank you. Can we maybe just put a time limit to it that we don't get the plan within a year? But it must be reasonable because just putting a plan together is not going to be taking a month. But can we have some kind of a time frame to this that we can set? That is my proposal. Thank you.
Yeah. A month from now with some progress. Might not be the plan, but when we meet next as a committee, in the fourth term, then maybe you can come and tell us, well, we're working on it, it's work in progress or whatever.
Can I suggest, Chair, that we say 3 months? I'll tell you why. We have to pull in our sister departments. And all our sister departments have their own problems. So let's say in 3 months, we must come and give you a plan.
Yeah, before the end of the year, Chair. So we sleep over it during the recess.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to add to what they should do. Remember, I said we must guide the
the officials on what we want to hear. Please, can you also, I said to check the people who have been affected. Please check with Compensation Commissioner to say how much money has been spent on those people so that can be used to try and do the remedy of awareness. Because we found that there's a lot of funds that have been wasted because of what the people have done. It's illegal just to get the compensation.
Honorable Ka, well, you are covered. We're keeping you here most of the time, and looking at that, when I say we, I'm talking to the department. I know it is our duty to do oversight. So, Minister, we're trying to complete what we started. We have not interacted with forestry and fisheries. So before we get tired of each other, I think we need to focus on those now, forestry and fisheries, specifically fisheries. We did not get the annual performance plan. It was not tabled, and it could not come to us. We suspected at one point it might have been with agriculture, but we found out it's not the case. So we want that on Tuesday. And forestry, I'm not sure about forestry, but we have never heard anything from forestry. They do have their. They didn't even. Okay. But in summary, you'll know better what is not there and there. We want annual performance plans for the two.
So the other presentations, you will postpone them to a later date.
Postpone the other
presentation. And Tuesday it's forestry, Friday it's fisheries.
We want to do them both on Tuesday.
Friday is the last day.
So there won't be a meeting on Friday?
Yes.
We won't present to you on Friday.
No, we will not have a meeting on Friday. You will present to us on Tuesday both. So that's generally, I think the crux of this thing is that we don't know anything about fisheries, and we are approaching, people are approaching us from all directions. We want to get information from the department before we talk to any other person. So that's what will happen. I think it will be properly communicated so that you know what you must prepare. But there will be no meeting on Friday. Otherwise, on Wednesday, the 18th, we have got a meeting with the Namibian Parliamentary Standing Committee on Natural Resources to discuss how South Africa deals with the poison leaf, which is scientifically known as, I may not be able to pronounce this, is Dicarpetalum cymosa. But we expect honorable members of the committee to be there. Any support, we'll seek support to understand what is all this. They will deal with that. But I'm saying we should honor such meetings. If people come from another country to come and say they want to understand something should help them to understand. That's how especially countries in our vicinity here, we have got troubles with many other countries. Those in SADC must support parliament, must learn to work with other parliament. So that is what will happen on Wednesday, the 18th. And I think from there, we have indicated already that on Friday, we don't want the department here. I also picked out that there's a feeling that we expect everybody to be here every day. That's not the understanding of the committee. All we want, the person who accounts to us is the minister. It's not everybody, DG, not everybody. It is you who decide who must come, who will add value in your being here. So I thought as well we must communicate that message. Because equally so, we want people out there, those we represent, to be served. You are not serving us. We are supposed to serve our communities. But we also want to know how are you serving them. So hence the coming in here, of course, would always want clear explanations. It will not be enough if you say, Minister, when you are here, hey, I have left so-and-so. Who should have provided? Then that's your determination as to how best who can come in here. So I think in principle, we also would want to see you serving the people out there. Equally, we want, because we also meet them, they talk to us. We also want that, but not all the time, every day you are here. It's not our wish that you should all be here every day. Otherwise, thank you very much. Let's see you next week on Tuesday. Before...
Chairperson, my apologies for next week. I'll be out of the country. I would have liked to hear about this poison leaf. The only poison leaf I know is the Durban poison. Thank you.
My apologies as well. I'm also not here next week due to studies.
Okay. The meeting is adjourned.